Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
A Greek salad in Europe. A chain reaction from Athens to London as concerns over Greek debt produce a wave of uncertainty across Europe and send a sell-off wave across the Atlantic. Now, U.S. markets are poised to react to a negative unemployment number out of the U.S. government this morning and send the sell-off wave back across the pond. In the global economy, there's no kiddie pool. Everyone gets wet. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, February 5th, and The Takeaway is trying to track this latest wave of global uncertainty as we all wait for the latest unemployment number out of the government this morning.
You know, along with the positives of globalization, this is what a lot of people were afraid of, was the fact that one failure somewhere would be a failure everywhere.
Right, we're all wet.
Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Toyota may be eyeing yet another recall this hour. The company is reportedly considering a recall of 270,000 Prius hybrid cars in the U.S. and Japan because of problems with the braking system. Any moment now, Toyota CEO will give a statement and answer some questions. Earlier on The Takeaway, we asked Jerome Vaughn, news director of member station WDET in Detroit, what we can expect to hear.
I think he's going to apologize. I think he's going to reiterate how safe Toyota cars really are. And that's probably about it. Probably not a lot of detail.
The Prius problems don't end with the brakes. The Los Angeles Times is reporting there have been over 1,000 complaints about the headlights shutting off without warning. And other Prius owners have complained of their cars shutting off completely, often while in motion.
The Toyota story has been moving the markets. We're also waiting for the unemployment number out of the Labor Department later on this morning. And Wall Street futures were down earlier this morning. Michael Hunter joins us, what markets reporter with the Financial Times. Jittery markets all over the world. Where do we stand at this hour, Michael Hunter?
Well, in London, we've got a really bad dose of those jitters, John. The FTSE 100, which is the biggest benchmark index on the European continent, is currently down about 92 points. It lost a similar margin yesterday as well. And you're right, it's all about uncertainty, and it's all about just how much of a bath global investors are going to have to take if those U.S. jobs data numbers don't come in as forecast.
And we really are talking about a solid line connecting uncertainty in Greece with the unemployment number in Washington, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. There's this growing storm of doubt around the global economy. It's not just a Washington problem or a problem in Athens or a problem in Greece. It's a problem everywhere, really, because it's drawn attention to quite how much of the rally that we've seen since November last year has been dependent on government
stimulus. And it's starting to erode, absolutely starting to erode. Michael Hunter, markets reporter with the Financial Times. Thanks for that.
The NATO offensive in Afghanistan is underway this morning. British troops are now carrying out helicopter advances in the Helmand province. They're preparing the battlefield for what will be one of the biggest assaults in the eight-year-old war. General Stanley McChrystal, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, says one reason he announced the offensive in advance was to give insurgents a chance to lay down their arms.
We're trying to signal to the Afghan people that we are expanding security where they live. We are trying also to signal to the insurgents, the Taliban primarily in this area, and the narco-traffickers, that it's about to change.
U.S. commanders say the offensive will be backed by a larger Afghan contingent than ever before. And in Haiti, the 10 Americans who tried to take children out of the country last week without permission have been charged with kidnapping. They face prison terms of up to 15 years and not eligible for bail. Looking at the markets, Asian markets down, futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,002. The S&P starts at 1,063, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,125. We're going to be talking to the founders of the Iris Photo Collective in Miami about a project that portrays the really complicated connections between Haiti and her neighbor, Cuba.
It's apparently official out of Tokyo. The CEO of Toyota has officially apologized for the worldwide recalls. We'll get more of those details later on in the morning. We're also discussing gridlock on Capitol Hill. When have you solved a stalemate in your life? Give us the story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, all the economic numbers.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Well, they really love acronyms there on Wall Street. I don't know if you were listening yesterday. Some of the financial channels were talking about the PIGS. Did you hear them?
No,
it's an acronym for Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, and the worries about debt in
those
countries.
That's an unfortunate.
They're talking about the European pigs. No, no, no morality there on Wall Street. But anyway, it is a serious issue. Certain debt incurred by nations in Europe created a wave of uncertainty that caused sell-offs in Europe and in the United States. And now we're poised to learn the latest unemployment rate for the month of January here in the United States, and it could send the wave back across the Atlantic or even across the Pacific. To help explain this chain of events and to figure out if actually we're talking about a broader turnaround than just a blip is Dan Gross, columnist at Newsweek, joins us from Connecticut. Good morning, Dan.
Morning.
And Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times, who usually joins us on Monday for the agenda. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
So, Marcus, first of all, explain this chain of events. And you know what I'm talking about, the pigs, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a flattering term, and it is intentionally not a flattering term. Wall Street, you know, can be a bit of the drama queens sometime. And so they like words like pigs, terms like pigs. It's very illustrative. In this case, it's about what we're calling the peripheral economies of Europe, of the Eurozone currency. And these are countries that are heavily indebted. We in the U.S. know something about that because we're heavily indebted. But these countries don't have our protection, our shield of the dollar. And they are Europe's kind of laggards. And so while you have strong core economies in Europe like France and Germany, you know, these guys are the cabooses dragging the thing down, is what you could say the pigs are doing. The problem is that they're heavily indebted. The problem is, you know, they were profligate spenders even before the recent financial crisis and the global downturn. Well, every country in the world has been spending a lot during the global downturn to keep their economies from cratering even more. You try to stimulate your economy. You spend billions of dollars doing that. That means these guys' debts have gotten even bigger. The concerns in the markets is that their debts are so big that their national debt, their sovereign debt, that this is the bonds of the government's risk, that they issue are actually too big a risk now, and so you slap them down. The credit default swaps, this is something you hear a lot. This has been a huge issue for us before in the markets. These are insurance on sovereign debt. So when a country issues a bond, that's the debt. It's the U.S. bonds are debt. The U.S. government will have to pay later. You have to also take out insurance on the fact that, you know, you have risk inherent in doing that. Well, these guys have huge budget imbalances. That means that those bonds are riskier. That means the insurance that they're paying on every bit of debt they issued in a country like Greece, one of the pigs, has doubled in the last month. So that means that their costs are really galloping away.
And
the markets are betting against them, saying they can't keep doing it.
And it's a double-barreled jitter when you've got the insurance possibly being worthless and the bond that it's supposedly propping up also worthless.
Exactly.
Now, Spain's aggregate sovereign debt is upwards of 12% of its gross domestic product. Dan Gross, our projected deficit would be around 11% if the Obama budget passes through at this rate. Is the fact that we are such a debtor nation keep us from being insulated from these kinds of waves, Dan Gross?
No, I think there's something else that keeps us from being insulated, and that is that we control our own monetary policy. In other words, our central bank can lower and raise interest rates. We control our own fiscal policy. We decide what to spend, and we control our own currency. We have the dollar. The big problem for the Greeks, and the old saying, beware of Greeks bearing rifts.
Oh, my goodness.
Sorry.
You just took us off the air there, Dan. That's it.
In the olden days, if a country like Greece got into trouble, it would solve its problem by aggressively devaluing its currency.
Right.
And then inflating the debt away. Well, when you're on the euro, you can't single-handedly deflate that currency. So they're in the same currency and have the same monetary policy as Germany and France and Spain, all these economies that have kind of vastly different things going on right now. So in a previous time, the drachma would be crashing. We would all be making our plans to go to the Greek islands for August because things would suddenly seem cheap. But because Greece is on the euro,
right,
and because Spain is on the euro, they've lost the flexibility to deal with those sorts of issues.
And that's exactly why
this is a big kind of existential question for the European Monetary Union.
It's political instability, but it certainly makes the point that Marcus Mabry was making a moment ago, and that is that they do act like the cabooses, pulling the rest of the train right off the tracks because they're all on the euro. So Marcus Mabry, the Labor Department is going to issue this unemployment number for January. Are people in Saudi Arabia and Singapore really, and Europe, tuning into this because they care about U.S. workers and will cry real tears if more of them are unemployed?
They're tuning in, but not because they care about American workers, although they do, because you need American workers to have jobs to buy Saudi oil, for instance. What we're seeing both and what we're seeing in kind of the fear of contagion from a sovereign debt bomb. There's a debt bomb out there. Just like we were all over-leveraged, we American consumers, well, countries were over-leveraged too. And this, what we're seeing is this global contagion, this fear that this debt bomb will start exploding all over the global markets, starting in Europe, starting with the pigs, but then even going to other countries that are in the core of Europe. And then we've seen the Asian markets this morning afraid of it. So it's kind of this fear sweeping the globe. Well, it's the same thing. The U.S. employment situation, how our economy recovers, how strong that recovery is, whether or not it creates jobs, is going to impact
right.
lots of other countries around the world. So based on what that number is today, we can expect markets to react to that further. If it's a less suspicious number than expected, then given already what the stress that markets are under because of the debt bomb fears from Europe, it's going to be ugly.
Right. Dan Gross, in the less than a minute that we have, is the debt bomb that Marcus describes something different than the recession or something we should watch to gauge where the recession is for ordinary Americans?
Well, these debt problems in Europe, I think, are a symptom of the fact that when you have very low growth, your tax revenues come in much less than expected, thus creating these debt issues. You know, for the U.S., it's a slightly different issue. Our economy is growing very rapidly. The GDP was at 5.7%. The jobs are not keeping up, in part because American companies have been insane about getting more productivity.
Right.
The productivity number came out this previous week. It was
above
6%.
Yeah, which
this
means
is three quarters in a row where the productivity level has been three times the historical norm. What that means is companies are working like crazy.
No, I got it. It means doing more with less, and it's a part of the economic pain that we're all feeling. Dan Gross and Marcus Mabry, thanks so much. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's get some of the headlines.
Toyota's president has just apologized to customers during his first news conference since the massive global recalls began last month. The grandson of the company's founder had been criticized for not being more visible during the crisis. Also this morning, we've learned that Toyota is considering a recall on 270,000 Prius models because of brake problems, and they're now also looking into similar problems that may affect their Lexus brand. The Labor Department releases the January jobless report in about an hour. Wall Street economists expect it to show a tiny increase in employment. Moving abroad, 10 American missionaries who've been charged with kidnapping children in Haiti are facing up to 3 months in detention as they wait for trial. They were arrested after they tried to take 33 Haitian children out of the country following the earthquake.
In Iraq, a car bomb explosion on the outskirts of the southern holy city of Karbala has killed at least 20 Shiite pilgrims. And here in the U.S., forecasters say a major winter storm is threatening some parts of the Mid-Atlantic, with D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia expected to be the most affected areas. Meteorologist Bruce Terry from the National Weather Service says it's going to be a very dangerous storm.
In addition to 1 to 2 feet of snow accumulation on the ground, it will become very windy later Friday night and Saturday. So in a lot of places, there's going to be near blizzard conditions or maybe blizzard conditions.
The storm is expected to create those conditions before it moves out tomorrow. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning coming up. A good week or a bad week? You made some nominations. So did The Week magazine. We're going to take a look at them.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts on the news, and let's go first to our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. He was on Capitol Hill yesterday, and he got to see the new senator from Massachusetts, Scott Brown, get sworn in. Todd, what was it like yesterday?
Hi, good morning, Celeste. Yeah, Scott Brown was sworn in around 5 p.m. in the Senate chamber by Joe Biden, the vice president. About half the Senate in attendance, more Republicans than Democrats, but not a fully attended affair. Brown actually ruffled some feathers because he showed up a week earlier than the Massachusetts delegation expected him, but they all got over that. And then afterward, as is done with new senators, he walked from the Senate chamber to the old ceremonial Senate chamber for a photo op, and we got a chance to catch up with him a little bit and find out how he was feeling about being a newly minted senator. Listen to this.
Very balanced and excited.
What are you going to be doing tonight after the...
Just going to spend some time with my wife and get a nice dinner.
Well, there's a few good restaurants in Washington, D.C., but as the crucial 41st Republican senator, how is he expected to affect the debate over the jobs bill?
He went to an Irish pub, by the way. That's where he ate dinner.
Yeah, probably, right?
Well, the jobs bill is next. Harry Reid, the majority leader, has said that he wants to try to have a first vote on a new Democratic jobs bill on Monday. Now, we don't even know exactly what's going to be in it yet. He's trying to use some fast-tracking procedures. The only reason I'm telling you this is that without 60 votes like the Democrats used to have, it will be darn near impossible to do it. So how Scott Brown votes, or any other Republican for that matter, is incredibly important. If Reid can't get Republicans over to his side on a jobs bill, they're not going to be able to move this by the end of the week like they say they want to do.
Okay, thanks so much. That's Todd Zwillig, our Washington correspondent. You know, while Todd was there yesterday, he also had a chance, among other reporters, to talk to Vice President Joe Biden. And this is what Joe Biden had to say.
Look, the president meant what he said when he said in the State of the Union, he's open to suggestions. Anything that meets the goals that the president set out for health care, and I'm confident the president is going to be inviting the Republican leadership and to come down, sit with us in a serious discussion and say, okay, guys, what do you want?
Okay, so okay, guys, what do you want? Is that the solution to gridlock? We're asking you, the listeners out there, when you have gridlock in your own lives, when you've locked horns with someone, how do you solve that? Were you able to solve that? Give us your stories of gridlock in your personal life at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Gridlock in your personal life. I'm trying to think of what that would be.
It's when you just feel like you cannot talk to somebody about anything.
Divorce, right?
Except
I think,
the weather.
The response to gridlock.
So Ibrahim Abdelmateen, is he confident with his sports pick? It is Super Bowl weekend this weekend. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
So our takeaway sports contributor, it seems like we've been talking about the Colts matching up with the New Orleans Saints pretty much all season long.
I think you have been talking about it, actually.
It was the Super Bowl I wished for.
There you go.
So what do you think of this matchup? And are you going to make a prediction?
Well, okay, so there's a couple things about the matchup that are really important. You had asked a question about the penalties of the offensive line of the Colts. And I couldn't find that specific stat, but the Saints have 89 penalties for the year. The Colts have 74.
Wow.
So if you want to look at it in terms of mistake-proof football, the Colts have the edge. Both of those two teams are among the four least sacked teams. So the Colts are number one in terms of protecting Peyton Manning,
right.
And the Saints are number four in terms of protecting Drew Brees. So you don't expect a game where you're going to have a defensive, line come and destroy the quarterback and really change the character of the game. The quarterback's going to have the opportunity and the ability to do what they need to do to put their team in the best position to win. The other thing that's going to be important is a stop in this game, because the offenses are so strong, is going to be a field goal.
It's
going to be an offensive game. And I think what it's going to come down to is going to be turnovers. Once again, turnovers. How are people going to capitalize on those mistakes?
So, we hope it's not a mistake, but you want to make a prediction?
Well, okay, so my thing about this game is that the Saints, after 2005, after what happened with Katrina, there's a whole nation of people that had to leave New Orleans.
Nope.
Those people are all over the country. This is the new America's team. Exactly.
They
and they're
going to
send their energy down to Miami.
So.
And that's why I'm going to go. My heart is going with the Saints. My mind is going with the Colts. But on this game, I'm going with my heart.
All right. He's on the fence, though, I think. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor. Thanks so much.
Good morning.
It is Friday. And so in a joint effort with our friends at The Week magazine, we're going to look back and see who had a good week and who didn't. This is our segment called Good Week, Bad Week. First up, somebody who had a very good week. He's furry. He lives in Pennsylvania.
Oh, that's easy.
Yeah, it's the groundhog. Here's Michael Johnston, an official with the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club.
This year, he did see his shadow. He was frightened back into his burrow and is anticipating 6 additional weeks of cold weather.
That's Punxsutawney Groundhog Club announcing the yearly ritual, and he may have been scared by his shadow, but he wasn't frightened by the folks at PETA, who this year insisted that Phil the Groundhog be replaced by Phil the Robot.
To quote our president, Phil is treated better than the average child in the state of Pennsylvania. He has two regularly scheduled visits to a veterinarian each year. He lives in a climate-controlled, state-licensed and inspected habitat called the Groundhog Zoo, which is right in the center of Punxsutawney. He leads a very coddled life and certainly flourishes in that lifestyle.
Thanks
good
for
week
clearing
for,
that up. Yeah.
for coddled rodents in Pennsylvania. We'd like to say one of the many Grammy winners on Sunday had a good week, but not really. Even if you win four Grammys, that can be kind of a downer if you sing out of key at the show.
She wears short skirts, I wear T-shirts. She's cheer captain and I'm on the bleachers.
That's Taylor Swift.
A little raggedy there.
Taylor Swift is the winning nominee for the bad week.
Because she dropped one of her many Grammys.
Oh, she also
Grammys
dropped
on the
one
red
of her Grammys. Yeah, she won
right.
four Grammys. She dropped one and she broke it. I assume they can get her another one, though.
So the rodent gets the good week. Taylor Swift gets the bad week. If you've got nominations, send them to us at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Listener Shab Adele wrote from Detroit, who's having a bad week? Toyota. Good week. Detroit auto companies, primarily Ford and GM. Send us your nominations every week. You can call 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And you can see the full Good Week, Bad Week feature in The Week magazine. It's on newsstands and online now.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a group of Baptists from Idaho are now facing the possibility of 15 years in prison and no possibility of bail either. That's over charges of kidnapping after attempting to take 33 Haitian children over the border into the Dominican Republic, and we're going to discuss that in a minute. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. This hour, Toyota's president apologized for the automaker's global recalls and promised to beef up quality control by setting up a special committee that he would head himself. The president acknowledged that the new Prius that went on sale last year has braking problems, but did not announce a recall, only saying the company is considering one. One of the largest offenses in the Afghan war has begun this morning. British attack helicopters are now clearing the outskirts of the city in Marja in preparation for NATO troops to come in. General Stanley McChrystal, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, was asked why he announced the Helmand offensive in advance.
We're not interested in how many Taliban we kill. We'd much rather have them see the inevitability that things are changing and just accept that.
The assault on Marja itself will be the first operation to employ some of the 30,000 new troops that are part of President Obama's surge.
New details being reported this morning about the attempted Christmas Day bomber. CBS News is reporting that the suspect has told investigators he was actually directed to carry out the attack by the radical Yemeni cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. And here at home, the latest unemployment numbers will be announced in about an hour from now. Expectations are for a small net increase in jobs, but the jobless rate itself is expected to creep up to 10.1%. But the predictions have been wrong in the past. Futures on Wall Street are down, although they've been coming back a little bit as the morning has progressed. World stocks tumbling for the second straight morning. Concerns about ballooning European debt and that rise in U.S. unemployment. And yesterday, the Dow fell briefly under the 10,000 point for the first time since November. And if the futures stay the way they are, it's likely to open under 10,000 as well. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets down. The Dow gets underway at 10,002, just a smidge above 10,000. And the S&P starts at 1,063. The NASDAQ, which is actually doing the best this morning, opens at 2,125. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
10 members of an Idaho-based Baptist group have been charged with kidnapping in Haiti after they tried to spirit 33 children over the border into the Dominican Republic. And by now, we're all familiar with the details. The group claims the children were orphans and say they were trying to help them. The Haitian government isn't buying it, and in fact, they've charged them with kidnapping. The possibility is 15 years in prison, and they say there is no chance for posting bail. The Reverend Patrick Mahoney says his organization, the Christian Defense Coalition, has been in contact with the Haitian ambassador in Washington and with the detained Americans church in Idaho.
We understand that perhaps procedurally things were not properly done, but they are in no way kidnappers. They are in no way traffickers.
We have it with us now, Mark Johnson. He's a longtime Idaho resident. He's now president of Gallatin Public Affairs in Boise. He spent 9 years as the chief of staff to Idaho's former governor, Cecil Andrus. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Celeste.
Help us understand or get our minds around this group from Idaho, from this Baptist church there that wanted to go help the children in Haiti. Help us kind of understand the community out of which they came.
Well, you have to. First thing you have to understand is it's a very churched area. This is a highly religious state, maybe one of the more religious places in the country in terms of people's attendance, regular attendance at church. It's a fast-growing area, fastest-growing area in Idaho. So you have had an influx over the last 15 or 20 years of people from all over the country moving to southwest Idaho.
Yeah, it's an amazing transformation, really, what Boise was, say, 20 years ago.
Yeah, no, very true, John.
You know, the not having lived in Idaho, but just knowing it from the people that I know there, there's this kind of idea of Idaho as this very libertarian, very independent, strong-minded state. And to that extent, this story kind of makes sense, that these are people who saw a problem in Haiti and said, well, we're going to go over there and we're going to fix it.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's probably a myth in a lot of ways, but there is a notion about the West, and Idaho subscribes to this in the main, that you're a place of rugged individuals. They take action based upon seeing a problem and trying to solve it. So I think the local reaction in the main has been no rush to condemn these people by any means. I've noticed, for example, none of the major newspapers in Idaho have editorialized on this yet. I think, like most of the rest of us, we're waiting to figure out exactly what happened and what the motivations were. But there's been no rush to condemn. Probably a sense developing that these folks were, to give them the benefit of the doubt, well-intentioned, but probably awfully naive about the way they were going about approaching this, not very sophisticated.
What's been the response from the community? Is this the top topic of conversation at the local diner? Or?
I'd say it's been certainly a topic of conversation. It's dominated the news coverage for the last several days. Particularly in the southwestern corner of the state, the largest population area of the state. But at the same time, a couple of days ago, Boise State was signing their new football recruits, so that was above the fold in the local newspaper.
Yeah.
And they're nationally ranked, so.
Well, and potentially a national contender next year.
So tell me a little bit about this church and its place within the religious communities. It's a large, very high-profile church with a lot of standing?
I would say no. In fact, I only vaguely aware of it. My personal religion is Catholic, which would be kind of the second most dominant religious affiliation in Idaho.
Mormon being the
largest. LDS community would be very, very strong in this part of Idaho. And then a whole range of from sort of the evangelical, conservative, right, religious right, if you will, to a more mainstream Protestant denominations, the Methodists and that sort of thing. So, but lots of church going, lots of people that are very, very engaged in a sense that, you know, we're trying to help here.
You know, the religions you refer to the Mormons, and you also refer to some of the new evangelical religions. There are often explicit doctrines within those religions of conversion and missionary work. And I'm wondering if people in Idaho are maybe more familiar with this than other people in the country because of the presence of the Mormons and,
sure.
and some of these other groups, sort of understand exactly where this church is coming from. Maybe in a way that others in America don't.
I think that's a fair statement, John. I think there is a missionary zeal in a lot of these denominations that is sort of at the core of what they're all about. They believe passionately in what they believe in, and they believe that other people ought to, you know, have an opportunity to be converted. So there is that attitude, no question about it.
And the sort of higher power can trump the paperwork at the border there, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you're describing a community that's kind of waiting to see, that's not rushing to condemn and is having the sort of stay out of everyone else's business attitude. Does that hold clear for pretty much everything in Idaho?
Well, you mentioned the libertarian streak that runs through the state. I think there is a sense that, you know, mind your own business. I won't get in your way if you don't get in mine. And that's a strain that is long dominant.
Or if you're talking about Ruby Ridge, it goes a little beyond that even.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think is going on here, and probably fairly far down the list of concerns in Idaho, but we've had some, as you suggest, John, some image problems in the past that have been driven the narrative that Idaho is a place where crackpots come to reside. An unfair image in my estimation, but nonetheless, I think you're probably seeing a little bit of that reaction at home.
Okay, that's Mark Johnson. He's the president of Gallatin Public Affairs in Boise, former Idaho journalist, and he spent 9 years as chief of staff to Idaho's former governor, Cecil Andrus. He's reacting to the news out of Haiti that 10 members of an Idaho-based Baptist group have been charged with kidnapping as they attempted to take 33 children out of Haiti and into the Dominican Republic. Coming up, we're going to talk to the founders of the Iris Photo Collective. It's out of Miami. They have a new project that portrays, that uses photographs and essays from some very well-known writers to talk about the complex relationship between people of Haitian descent and those of Cuban descent. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Bobby, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Bobby Marshall, president of online ticket selling. Everyticket.com, can you get me tickets for the big game?
I absolutely can. How many would you like? 10, 20, 30?
30? You know, it's a smaller group. Let's say 6. How much is that going to set me back?
Done. If you want to sit premium seats, lower level, probably looking at about $4,000 a ticket, so roughly right around $24,000 to get you into the game.
Now, Bob Marshall, president of Everyticket.com, I would have thought that's a low number. My feeling was, you know, maybe they'd be $10,000. Is the price going to maybe go up between now and actually Sunday?
It could. It kind of bounces around a little bit between that number. I think yesterday was around $3,700. It could probably go up to right around $4,500, somewhere in that ballpark is what we're projecting.
So I'm talking to you. You are in Miami at this point, right?
That's correct.
Now, if economic indicators, we look at a lot of them on this program, can we look at the Super Bowl tickets and the market for Super Bowl tickets? And, of course, this is the highest rated, you know, television event possibly in the world. Have they fluctuated this year?
John, they have. It's gone down from the last time the Super Bowl was in Miami, that same ticket I just quoted you at, which is, that's a bargain, was about $8,500, and the Super Bowl was played here in 2007. So for the same type of seat, so you're looking at half the price, basically.
And does that make things bad for you, or does it just mean more people can go and actually get involved?
Well, what actually is happening is less people are going. That's what's bringing the price down, and it's not great for obviously the opportunity is there for people to still come down today, tomorrow, and go to the game for much cheaper than what they've been able to in the years past. As far as bad for us, it's probably better when the price was higher, so there's more margins to work with, sure.
So where do you get your tickets? I mean, do you actually buy them, or do people buy them and then put them on your site and get a piece of the action themselves?
We do carry quite an extensive inventory, but also we do sell other people's tickets as well. So we would get them probably from fans that decided, hey, I can make some money on this ticket. The face value on most of the tickets is anywhere $800 to $1,000. 800 being for a lower for upper level seat, and 1,000 for an upper lower, excuse me. And they usually mark them up, and we see what we can do with them.
All right, if I wanted to sit in the cheapest seat in the stadium, what would that be?
You'd be looking at an upper level. We'd maybe throw in a pair of binoculars, but it'd be about $1,350.
$1,350 still.
Still, exactly correct. But again, in years past, last time the Super Bowl was played here, that ticket was about $3,000.
Now, you know, we're in partnership with ProPublica, who's a website that actually takes a look at Capitol Hill, and we're trying to figure out how maybe congressmen and senators would be going to the game. You know, I'm calling you to try to get tickets. How do lawmakers and big shots actually end up getting tickets usually?
An assistant calls.
Well, that's for sure. But is there a big business in, like, donated tickets or passing them around to VIPs?
What do you mean? Donated tickets, like...
Well, I mean, I want you to come to the game. I'm going to give you a gift. Are tickets gifted a lot?
Sometimes, yes. That's true, yes. We actually have gift certificates, and people do call up and say, hey, I want to take, you know, such and such. This person's been an important part of my, you know, whether it's an anniversary gift or for someone as a gift or at work or something. Not much work-related lately.
Finally, can you give me the breakdown, New Orleans fans versus Indianapolis fans? Who's winning?
I would say for sure a lot more New Orleans fans, definitely.
Right. Bob Marshall, president of Everyticket.com, selling premium tickets to sold-out events. He's got tickets for the Super Bowl. Get them now.
Not just gorgeous photos, not just incredible essays from some very, very famous writers, but a photojournalism project that examines a very complex relationship between the people of Haiti and the people of neighboring Cuba. We're going to be discussing the people who put this project together in just a few minutes. Stay with us for that. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. This morning, Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, gave his first press conference since the company began its massive recalls. He apologized to customers and promised to improve quality control by setting up a special committee that he would head himself. The company's president also admitted the 2010 Prius has brake problems. He did not announce a recall, but is saying the company is considering one. Yesterday, California Representative Daryl Issa said the government is launching an investigation into the Prius issues.
What we're going to ask Toyota to do is be transparent in showing us what they know, what they suspect, and what they're doing about it.
Toyota is now looking into whether some of their Lexus hybrids are also affected by braking problems. In economic news, analysts expect the January jobless report to show only a small increase in employment. That says President Obama is pressing Congress for a new jobs bill.
Big story out of the Federal Reserve this morning. It's buying $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities. It's an effort to literally prop up the economy, particularly the housing sector. But they plan to stop the purchases on the final day of March. The Fed says they might consider reopening the program if interest rates spike this spring. In Washington, GOP Senator Scott Brown of Massachusetts was sworn in yesterday, a week earlier than he planned. And the Mid-Atlantic is bracing for a serious snowstorm now that Scott Brown is sworn in. 2 feet of snow expected in some areas, including D.C. The big storm has led to preemptive action by airlines. Several of the big companies are waiving fees for passengers who want to change their flying dates to avoid the winter storms. Weather waivers have been offered by Delta, United, Continental, U.S. Airways, and AirTran. Check with your own carrier. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
This week, we welcome Miami and all of South Florida to the Takeaway family with WLRN down there. And we've been talking to some very prominent thinkers and writers from the region, prize-winning writers like Dave Barry and Leonard Pitts and also Edwige Danticat. Two of those writers, Pitts and Danticat, contributed to a collection of essays and photographs that not just caught our eye, it catches the eye. The collection is called Havana and Haiti, Two Cultures, One Community. It was produced by our guests, Carl Just and Luis Rios. They're co-founders of the Miami-based Iris Photo Collective. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Luis, let's talk about some of the photos in here. There was one pair of photos that really struck me, and it's the only black and white set of photos in there. I'm looking at it now. On one side of the page, you have a black and white photo of two prostitutes in Havana. They're standing in the middle of the street. One is adjusting her hair, it looks like, and the other one's talking really animated with her purse slung over her back. On the other side, juxtaposed, is a photo out of Haiti with two little girls, possibly sisters, I guess, wide-eyed, looking at the camera, very beautiful little girls. One's clasping the other's hands to her breast, and they're dressed in these lovely lace gowns, I guess, little dresses. I guess they're going to communion. I mean, the picture of innocence juxtaposed with the photo of these prostitutes out of Havana. And I'm wondering how you chose these photos, what you were trying to say about these two communities.
What we have here are really two independent looks, I think, at in a very artistic way at the harshness of living, you know, in a place like Haiti and a place like Cuba. You can almost switch the two photographs. What's happening is there is a first communion day for the two young girls in Haiti. The other one are two young girls in the early morning hours, you know, after what we call the day's work. And, you know, when I first decided to put these together, this is the only pair of photographs that we compare and contrast. They're actually run in black and white for the sheer purpose of you know, looking strictly at context. You could have seen a similar photo in Haiti of young prostitutes, and it's what the sheer innocence that was in that first communion photo, you know, eventually can become, where you really have innocence in both photographs. And that was the intent of that, is that you have young, impressionable, young girls that go through this change that ultimately result in that because of things that are way beyond their control. And to run them in black and white, was really a way to point out the starkness and show the sort of the similarities between these two cultures.
There's another pair of photographs. In fact, let me contrast a couple of them, because there's a pair of photographs in which you show one Haitian detainee and one Cuban detainee, both of them in Guantanamo Bay, and those are sad photographs. They're not especially happy, but at the same time, you have photos of this incredibly colorful, looks like a sunrise, and a stone angel coming out of Havana. And out of Haiti, you've got this beautiful blue skyline over the ocean in Haiti, and the side of a boat that said, "God love me." It's like you have this message here of how complicated this is, these communities where life is so very difficult, and yet the people are so resilient and clinging on to hope.
And that's the point that we make, you know, with the entire set of photographs. Pretty much what we have learned about Haiti, sort of in a backward way, and Cuba, more specifically Havana, is that both of these peoples throw themselves into the ocean to come to South Florida, Miami specifically, for whatever reason, for either political reasons or economic reasons. In both cases, in both of those countries, we know about the economic upheaval, you know, and the complete desolation of Haiti. You look at Havana, and you know this unending wait for the fall of a dictator for the last 50 years that appears that it will never come. And what we do with the angel in Cuba, in Havana, is to offer hope, and that is the way that the Cubans, especially the expatriates that live in South Florida, the United States, look to the people there. This is a constant struggle for them. With Haiti, it's the very same thing. Both have strong Roman Catholicism backgrounds, and that is ingrained into their culture. And I think when they look to the United States to come to, that's the only way of freedom that they expect. There's a very famous line in a song that says, that talks about freedom, which means there's nothing left to lose. And for both of these peoples, there is nothing left to lose to obtain that freedom that they both so dearly, you know, want.
That's photojournalist Luis Rios. He's half of the team that produced this new book, Havana and Haiti, Two Cultures, One Community. The other is photojournalist Carl Joost. He's with the Miami Herald and co-founder of the Iris Photo Collective. Carl, did you go, when you were taking these photos, did you go knowing what kind of photos you wanted to take?
No, actually, these photos span 19 years, and they were never meant to be paired together. It's during the course of having an exhibit during our Basel in Miami, Luis and I kind of put our heads together and we started looking at images from both countries and saw, wow, this is dynamic bridge, this is the dynamic visual narrative that connects the two. And personally, my mother lived in Cuba and is of Cuban descent, and I'm of course was born in Haiti. So it is this dualism that keeps repeating in my life. So it was just a natural fit.
You know, in there you have a picture of Havana with the rainbow over it, which we were listening to Luis talk about. And there's another one that's a picture of Port-au-Prince before the earthquake, which is just a beautiful photograph. And there, it seems to be a comment upon the struggling and the suffering these two communities have gone through and how that has transformed them, maybe in parallel ways.
Yeah, I think both of them have a sense of home. And both of them are departing their home because they seek a better future. That rainbow that casts over Havana, yes, is beautiful, but you look at the buildings, they seem to be dated and deteriorating. Again, like Mr. Rios, as Luis had said, hope, faith, freedom are themes that keep echoing throughout this project. It was very important. Both Luis and I really respect the written word, and we also respect the visual narrative, but we wanted to have both narratives take equal space in the book. So we went through a lot of pain and design to make sure that one complements the other.
Okay, well, there are 19 years of work represented in this project, 28 images, 16 writers, 7 photojournalists participated, but the two that made it all possible are Carl Joost, a photojournalist at the Miami Herald, and Luis Rios, a photojournalist, editor of the Iris Photo Collective's latest project, Havana and Haiti, Two Cultures, One Community. You can look at the images on our website, thetakeaway.org.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.